Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Riff Hard podcast. My guests today are Tim Salt and Neil Fallon from the band Clutch. Clutch has been around for over 30 years with the same lineup, which is crazy. They've had 9 songs on the Billboard Top 200 charts. Their highest position was at number 11 in 2015 with the song Psychic Warfare. And they have a new single called Slaughter Beach that came out on August 16th. I hope you enjoy this episode. Here goes. Neil and Tim, welcome to the Riff Hard podcast.
Hi there.
Hello.
What's up? This is the first time Neil and I have ever done a Zoom interview together.
Really?
It's history in the making.
Yeah. I mean, do you guys usually do them separately?
Usually, yeah.
Glad to be the first.
Yes. It's like an old school style interview.
Minus the technology.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of old school, I actually was curious. You guys must have a record. I can't think of anybody else who has been able to stay together as long as you have with the same lineup. It's almost like winning the compatibility lottery. It's really unheard of that many people can stay together and keep going for that long. I mean, a band surviving for as long as you guys have is one thing, but surviving intact, that's crazy. So I'm wondering, why do you think you've been able to do that?
For me, it just always feels like the band is growing and that we're going somewhere. There's never been the point in time where I felt like there was a reason to quit and go back. You know, it always felt like the band was growing and moving and being artistically creative. So for me personally, that's really what has kept me going personally.
Right, with you, Neil.
I think it's a mixture of its work ethic. You know, maybe at the beginning when I was very young, just kind of fell into this and took it for granted because I had no point of reference. But as years went on, appreciated it more and more and became more protective about it and realized that what a rare scenario this all is. And there's also a bit of luck. I mean, I know a lot of bands tried their damnedest and fate dealt them a not so great hand. Knock on wood. You know, it's a great combination of both those things. And also what Tim said as well.
Also, we learned early on to be self-reliant as opposed to, you know, depending on record labels to give us tour support. You know, once we figured out that that wasn't going to be a thing forever, we figured out how to go out and tour on our own and make it work.
In terms of like where you can cut costs, what's smart to spend on, those types of things?
Yeah, exactly. And being able to, you know, make enough money to be able to cover the tour.
Yeah, I think that one of the big problems bands have is not doing the legwork to learn about how it all works from the inside. I think, and you know, I've personally known lots of people who just want to get the check from the label or from whoever's funding to just pay, get them on something and not think about it. Even if it is tour support, you know, the label, they're thinking about exactly how it fits into the master plan. And if it fits into the master plan and exactly how much they're going to shell out for this tour and what it means in the bigger picture. The label is thinking about that. Oftentimes bands aren't, but I think with a self-sufficient band, you know, it forces you to become aware of every dollar, where it goes. How early on did you guys take on that mentality baked in?
I remember early on, you know, we grew up in the shadow of, you know, the DC Discord punk scene. And they were, you know, one of the very first, or at least locally, regionally, was one of the first DIY labels. And there was also the major labels that were kind of knocking on bands' doors in the early 90s. And I remember we had many conversations about, do we do it this way or that way? So I think we always had that inclination. But there was managers who said to, you know, our young ears, you know, opportunity only comes around once. And if you don't open the door, it'll never open again. And so we did the major label thing for the 90s. And, you know, the Reader's Digest version is the last label we signed to. We had to go to court with to get money that they owed us. And they couldn't pay us that. So we were awarded our back catalog of 3 albums at that time. And then we realized it would be a fool's errand to go sign to another label when we were already doing all the work ourselves. And the internet had become a thing also at that point. So it was even easier for us to reach the fans that we had established over the past, you know, 15 years, getting tour support or just going on tours without tour support.
Do you think that the major label years set you up to be able to basically make the most of that situation and really make it work that way? Or do you believe that the fan base was established regardless? Like, was it a blessing, basically, to have spent that time on a major label?
Yeah, I mean, we were young, and they were our early albums. So I don't know if we really thought of it as a blessing back then. But looking back on it now, the opportunities, you know, just to get a booking agent that could get us on national tours was probably the more important thing than the label that the albums were on at the time.
Yeah. So the doors that it opened.
Yeah. I feel like the early major label days are where we figured out that the only way we're going to be able to survive is by touring.
And there's bands that to this day, there's a psychology that you're supposed to have this patron. The band's not supposed to have to do anything other than, you know, show up and play the music or write the music, and they're just incapable of anything else, or they don't want to do anything else. And I've met even recently managers kind of bragging about, oh, I signed my band to a multi-album deal with big time records, and isn't that great that I signed them to a 7-album deal in 2018. In my mind, that's completely backwards. And then they'll ask, well, what label you're on? And they'll say, oh, we put out our own records on Weathermaker Music. And sometimes the reaction is like, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Oh, you know, like, oh, that's just too bad. You don't have a patron. There's no communicating with somebody who has that driven into their head that the business model of 1974 is how you should conduct yourself now.
I think that patron model is so like hardwired because, you know, if you think about old school composers and artists, it's almost in the DNA of an artist to expect some rich entity to basically float them. I mean, that's basically how art history and music history came to be. So this idea of an independent artist really thriving, it's a relatively modern concept. And I think that a lot of people who have like benefited it off of the old way of doing it, or who just have heard about the old way of doing it and thought to themselves, wow, that's cool. If I could just get someone to give me some money, I could play guitar all day. It's very attractive to lots of people on the outside, I think. But I think that, you know, the further we get into the modern age, I think the more important it is for artists to realize that they really need to figure things out for themselves, because there were things, you know, you say the 1974 model, well, back then they did believe in artist development at least. So, you know, at least, you know, you could have a few years to make it work. That kind of stuff doesn't really exist anymore. So way harder to find an actual patron now, either way.
But it's also easier to find your niche. Those major labels, they were looking for the lowest common denominator of like across the board smash hits mm-hmm. that would pay for all the things that failed. But now, yeah, it's the A&R representative served its purpose as a gatekeeper for many, many decades. I don't envy bands that are trying to get heard now because the algorithm is the A&R representative. But on the other hand, if you have a very particular kind of music, you can find the people that like it. And that wasn't the case, you know, 20 years ago.
And I think that's one of the beautiful things about the time period we live in is the success you can have with ultra niche music, or maybe you're not going to be flying around in jets because of it. But I mean, if that's the reason you're playing music, I don't know. That's a weird reason. But I think that the idea of being able to be completely self-sustained in the modern age, even in ultra niche music, is totally realistic and amazing. It's a great thing. Just correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just assuming, but so I could be totally wrong. It seems to me like the modern way of getting music out and all the opportunities that are out there now, you know, that seems to be something that a band such as yourselves can really take advantage of and really work with? Or do you disagree?
Oh, I definitely agree 100%. It's just kind of funny at this point where there's so much physical demand for vinyl, and there's even so much demand for cassettes that we're actually printing our new album on cassette as well. And then, you know, we could reach our audience instantly on social media. So we've kind of got the best of both worlds going on right now.
Is the physical thing a surprise to you?
It is totally a surprise. Yes, for sure.
I say cassettes are what have really surprised me lately.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I did not expect to see that coming back.
People like them though.
I don't know for sure, but I wonder what the percentage of the people who buy cassettes have a functioning cassette player.
That's a good question.
Or does the cassette, does it sit on the mantle? I mean, I've got a couple old cassettes here that I just keep on there, like Black Sabbath Sabotage that we used to listen to in the band. I just like the way it looks. It's, you know, it's nostalgic in some ways.
I've thought about that too, because honestly, I don't even know when the last time I owned a CD player was, let alone a cassette player. It's been a long, long time. I mean, a standalone CD player, even. I don't know.
And I also think like hard rock and heavy metal, that this crowd seems to be more prone to want physical. I think we're fortunate in that the genre that we're in, they like the tradition of having the album in your hand and the tangible and tactile aspect of that. And it also, going back to your other question, all this modern stuff and being able to reach our fans affords us the opportunity to do the most traditional thing, which is get up on stage and play it live, you know, day after day after day after day, because for a band like us, that's what it's all about. And unless you're like got that support underneath, it gets very difficult to do. So like Tim said, we kind of have the best of both worlds.
So you guys still, after all these years, you're still all about the touring.
Probably more so than ever.
Interesting, because that's another thing. Like, keeping the same lineup, that's an anomaly. But then being more into touring as the years go by, that is another anomaly.
Yeah, I think over the years, the dressing rooms have gotten a little bit nicer. And the fact that there's showers in most venues really helps as far as comfort goes.
Well, those are the reasons, though. I think it's funny sounding, but I think actually like those types of things are what drive people away from wanting to do it. Not one time or two times, but 9 months straight of it, or, you know, 9 months a year for years and years and years and years of shitty showers or whatever will make someone not want to do it anymore.
Yep.
And it's like also a band like us, we're kind of playing, you know, small, mid-sized theaters, mid-sized rooms, sometimes in some cities, larger places. We're not, you know, this isn't a stadium band where everyone gets their own dressing room and then the car picks you up and takes you to the five-star hotel and then you fly. And I'm sure that's all very nice and posh, but at least we have a point of reference of having done the really grungy, nasty places that makes us appreciate the situation that we're in right now. I don't think we're really wish we were one of those bands that were being handed bathrobes as we walked off stage. So I think having, you know, kind of gone through the gauntlet is a good point of reference. I think if we were a band that had a hit like right out of the gates, it would have been a pretty bitter pill to swallow to downsize, which is like the death knell for a lot of bands. Having success too early gives you unrealistic expectations of the way the world really works, I think.
Yeah, I think too early in a band's career and also too young, they could be very, very dangerous things for someone's longevity. Man, I've thought about it. I can't imagine what it would be like to be like 18 or 19 and get mega famous off of a band or whatever. It seems like it would warp your head so badly beyond repair in most cases.
I would have been a disaster.
Oh yeah, me too. I mean, you hear about, I guess, the destruction that it causes to the people in those situations. I think most people would be a disaster. I don't think people are meant to handle that kind of attention 24/7. Our brains are not wired for it. I want to switch the topic to guitar. And one thing I'm curious about is, what is it that determines when you're going to play guitar, Neil, and when you're not? Is it just the arrangement? What's the decision-making process like with that?
I am not gifted with the kind of split-brain operation of singing and playing guitar that a lot of folks have. The general rule of thumb, and it's, you know, it's general, is if it's a riff that I wrote, I can sing on top of it because it was in my brain to begin with. If it's a riff that Tim or Dan wrote, particularly if it's in an odd time or if it's super fast, I find that trying to learn it compromises my ability to sing. Mm-hmm. And given the choice between the two, I'd rather sing as best I could. And 9 times out of 10, we don't need the second guitar. Tim and Dan have no problem holding that all down. Sometimes it is cool to have that second sound. I think particularly on slower songs where there's a lot more air and you can hear the dynamics between the two guitars better. That's usually it. I mean, there is a tempo threshold for me and a time signature threshold.
Playing and singing at the same time, I don't get it. I see some people like Dave Mustaine or something do it. I'm like, I don't understand how that works.
Yeah, there are some riffs that I have learned, and it's just a matter of hammering it over and over and over and over again till you're not thinking about it, till you're just doing the thing, and then you can have fun singing. But when you're kind of looking at your hand and then trying to remember lyrics, honestly, that's not fun. And I want to have fun.
Someone I know, and I forget who, I think, but I feel like it was on this podcast, told me that they were training themselves to sing and play at the same time because they had to for a tour. Like, they just joined some band and had to like just learn how to sing and play at the same time. They could sing and they could play, but they never had to do it together. And he was learning it basically note for note. So like one note, whatever syllable he was on or whatever, then next note or chord, and then whatever syllable, he just went syllable by syllable, note by note, word by word, and kind of just made it one motion, I guess, as opposed to two separate things. And he said that is a little more tedious. After a few weeks, he was way better at it and he didn't have to really think about it too much anymore.
I've done the same thing. There's songs on this new record where there's a guitar turnaround and I had to think about, okay, this syllable comes before or after the one, and then you move up a full step and then you wait and then the next word comes there. And then you just do that. And then it all kind of falls into place and then you can have fun theoretically.
Kind of becomes automatic. Tim, what about on your end when it's just you? Do you adjust your sound at all or your settings or your rig to compensate?
No, not necessarily. Sometimes I'll use more effects, I guess, when Neil is not playing guitar. So maybe that's my way of compensation, with some electroharmonics pog or maybe a little bit of phaser or some wah.
I'm sure it's part dependent.
Yeah. I do definitely like it when Neil plays guitar, though.
What about?
I don't know. It just kind of frees everything up, makes it feel a little more, I don't really know how to describe it. I guess less of a commitment for me. I guess I could play a little bit looser and a little bit more improvisational, I think, when I don't have to, you know, think about playing every riff perfectly.
That makes sense, because when it's just you, like, you've got to stick to the script.
Yeah, exactly.
For all intents and purposes, you've got to stick to the script. Or, like, if you take any freedoms, that's a crapshoot, I guess.
Yeah, I feel like it's more with the clutch, faster songs. A lot of the older stuff on the new album, like Red Alert or Strive for Excellence, I feel like, you know, should be stuck to the script. Whereas with the slower, looser stuff, it could be a little more improvisational and fun, like Neil said. Like, throwing in different stuff at different times is, you know, it's not like the album, but it could be fun.
Out of curiosity, nowadays, when you're getting ready for an album or a tour, what types of things do you practice? Like, do you practice like the same kinds of things that you did, like, say, 30 years ago? Or do you have any sort of routine or any techniques, or do you just play the songs? I'm just wondering, like, what your daily, like, I'm getting ready for something serious in a month. What do you do?
I like to try to relearn my old solos to be able to get them as close as possible. That's really the most time-consuming thing for me personally, trying to relearn an improvised solo that we ended up keeping on the album. Mm-hmm. So I definitely spend a lot of time doing that. And then just trying to memorize, well, right now, the new songs. We've got the 9 new songs that we're going to be playing on the next tour.
Hold on. I want to talk about learning old solos real quick because I want to understand something about that. So when you're saying relearning your old solos, do you mean relearning stuff from like 25 years ago that you've never played since the one time you improvised it?
There's that.
Okay. So some of it is like totally gone from the hard drive.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Well, I mean, most of the stuff that we end up keeping on the album is just improvised anyway. So I never knew the solo in the first place. Once the solo was actually there, that's when I have to learn it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, I don't have to, but, you know, I kind of feel rewarded if I could actually learn it the exact way that it was on the album. And then a couple weeks later, I usually just forget it anyway.
I don't know. It like puts you in that headspace too.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to, even if you're going to improvise another solo, like I feel like improvisation is all a matter of what we learn and what we take in. So that's why like sometimes too much music school makes people sound like too much music school, because that's what they're learning is the curriculum. They end up sounding like the curriculum. I mean, like you sound like what you learn and what you work on, what you listen to. So, you know, if you're learning your own solos, that's putting your own solos in the system.
Yes.
So how do you go about doing that? Do you slow them down or?
No, I just listen to them about 5,000 times. It's mostly about memorizing the thing, memorizing each little phrase. And then I can get the notes in easily after I fully memorize the entire thing.
And then when you do that, like, is that part of working on a set list, or is it more like just a thing you do on guitar to just get ready, but that might not be a song you're playing?
Yeah, it's more of a personal challenge than an actual rehearsal.
Makes sense. Do you hear stuff from back then and you're like, what in the fuck was I thinking?
Yes, absolutely.
Or sometimes that was fucking cool.
On a lot of the older stuff, I think there was production-wise a little kind of a different focus on guitars. There's a lot of doubling of solos on a lot of the earlier stuff, which ended up being really weird. I still haven't over these years decided if it's actually cool or not cool. Sometimes I hate it. Sometimes I love it. With albums like Jam Room in particular, or the B-side album Slow Hold to China, it definitely has a very bizarre guitar approach.
I want to hear more about what you consider bizarre.
You know, kind of when there's two Black Sabbath solos going on at the same time and they're slightly different.
Yeah.
I think I took it maybe a little too far by making them totally different solos, so like in one channel and the other channel. I still haven't decided whether I like it or not. I'm still
jury's still out.
I'm still thinking about production from the 90s.
The doubling solos thing is a interesting thing because, you know, we've all heard it done great. Then also hear it when it's like, was that even necessary?
Right, exactly. A lot of the older stuff was produced by this guy that we were using in Maryland, Larry Packer, who called himself Uncle Punchy. I know there's a different Uncle Punchy that's in metal as well.
Yeah, in Florida.
Yeah, this guy was in Maryland. A lot of the times we did the guitar tracks, we would just lay down like 3 guitar tracks and keep them all. You know, there wasn't really a huge amount of time to be in the studio working on individual parts. So we would just lay down a bunch of stuff and end up keeping it all.
How is that different than like, say, when you worked with Machine?
Each guitar part on the stuff with Machine is really made part by part, you know? Mm-hmm. There weren't really too many full tracks of guitar going through it. Like, we would just work on verses at one time, choruses at another time, intros and middle sections separately.
Do you have a preference?
No, not necessarily. I think they both end up working out.
Yeah, you can get great results either way. I know that some people think that you're not making music if you're going piece by piece, but I don't believe that for a second.
Yeah, I disagree with that too.
Yeah, there's a million ways to do it.
I think it's mostly with the older stuff. It was more of an older style recording. Yep. It was pre-Pro Tools and everything like that. So we just kind of had to go in there and play the songs.
Yep.
Whereas the modern approach is to not do that.
When you're doing an actual rehearsal, so separate from relearning old solos, when you're doing actual rehearsal for tour, like learning the set list, is that just a matter of running songs over and over?
For me personally, yes.
What about for you, Neil?
Look, for right now, like we have a whole batch of new songs, so we're running those over and over again. Some of them we've already been playing live. As much as we can, in the past, we would play songs live before we recorded, but for obvious reasons, we couldn't do that for this record. For a lot of them, it's going back and trying to remember, oh, this is almost a year ago that we recorded this. And then Mike listen very closely to what's being done. But as far as a body of work, as a set list, at the end of a tour, we'll have anywhere from 60 to 75 songs that we can draw from because we do a different set list every night. And usually what we'll do is Dan will do the first set list and he'll write the set list, you know, a few days ahead of time. We'll bang it out. And there's some kind of, I don't know, there's a switch that goes off. Like it seems to me, before we do anything, I think to myself, there's no way I can remember how to play half of these songs. And then we'll learn these 20 songs. And then for whatever reason, it seems like, oh, then I can remember the other 40. There's a kind of like just getting out of first gear, getting into second, getting into third, and the muscle memory applies even to the songs that you weren't actually honestly rehearsing. It's a bit of a head game for myself. And it also has to do with just warming up the vocals because you come out of the gates swinging for the fences, you kind of blow your voice out.
That's an interesting head game though. Like the, I'm never going to be able to do this. Cause I know that like, for instance, songwriters get that too. Like, you know, finish an album, finish an awesome song, or it hit like the end of a really good creative streak and then get that feeling of, well, how am I going to do this again? Or, you know, do something great. And then it's like, how the fuck am I going to repeat this? But then they do it. They just do it. They just sit down and write more good songs. And it sounds like it's a similar thing. It's like, how the fuck am I going to learn 40 more songs? But you've already done it a million times.
There's more songs every year. It gets harder. But it's a good exercise. And I think writing a different set list every night is a great mental exercise. I know if we were doing the same set list every night, I would go batshit crazy. I would also know that I would daydream. Like, okay, we're doing Mob Goes Wild. The next song is going to be Passive Restraints. Then I'm thinking about like, oh, where are we tomorrow? Is there any good restaurants around that venue? And the next thing you know, I'm screwing up the lyrics.
Yep.
Because I think it's good to look at a set list and be a little bit intimidated by it. Like, oh, we haven't done this song live in 3 years. And that's, I think, a better environment to stay frosty.
Keeps your adrenaline up if you're always in fight or flight.
I think it's good to have a little bit of fear, as long as it's within manageable, you know, doses.
Yeah, totally. So, okay. So I want to understand this a little more because I think memory is a fascinating thing. So you have the set list, the initial one, 20 songs a few days before the tour. And then that's what you go with. And as you're doing the tour, the set list night by night morphs to where by the end, it looks maybe outside of a few staples, like it's completely different. It's about right?
Pretty much every night is completely different.
Okay. So if you only worked on 20 songs, how do you guys go about getting like the 15 new ones on night two and then the 10 new ones on night three? Like, how do you guys go about making sure you're up to speed on that? Is it like, do you rehearse with each other like in the dressing room ahead of time? Or like,
we do definitely rehearse in the dressing room if songs aren't 100% rehearsed. But I mean, for this tour coming up, we just were on a 6-week tour. So we only have 2 weeks off. Mm-hmm. And like Neil said, we're doing 60 or 75 different songs. So right now we're pretty well rehearsed on the old stuff. We're just trying to add all of the newer songs that we haven't played yet to the set list. That's really the only real hardcore work that we're doing for this upcoming tour.
Man, what a discography. That's insane.
Well, yeah, we have too many songs probably. We should delete a few.
Are there any that you've never ever played live?
There's nothing I can think of off the top of my head. I mean, there's some stuff off Jam Room that's more like little studio interludes that we've never done.
I think there are plenty of songs that we've done once.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know we've done Gnome Enthusiast once.
Yep.
You know, it's sometimes playing these songs live first and recording is the way to go, because there have been plenty of times where we wrote something in the studio and like, oh, this is great. And then we went to the stage and we're like, oh, this is a different animal. And I'm sure we could beat up some of those songs to get them into fighting weight. But like Tim said, when there's so many, sometimes it's easier to say, okay, let's go with this then one that we know, you know, is a cooker on stage.
This is probably an unpopular opinion, but before I started doing URM and Riff Hard, I used to produce for a living. One thing that I remember bands saying to me was they didn't want to go nuts with certain layering or arrangement things because they couldn't reproduce it that same way live or whatever. And my thoughts were, I get that at the same time, I think that it's a fallacy to think that if a song can't be pulled off live, it's not a good song. There's some songs I think that they're just meant to be recorded and that's it. And then there's other songs that are meant for both. And then yet there's a whole other class of songs that don't sound good recorded, but sound crushing live. But I think they're all valid. It's interesting for me with those songs that you've played once and have just been like, eh, do you feel like those are lesser songs or just not good live?
Probably just not good live. Sometimes they're a little bit weird and awkward and I don't know, just doesn't really have the same feeling.
Doesn't translate the same way.
Yeah.
I think also we're not different from a lot of bands. So sometimes you got to get something out of your system.
Yes.
Artistically, like get a weird thing. Like we've done songs that smack of country music. We've done this like Gnome Enthusiast that sounds like Canned Heat to a degree. Careful with that mic that was, you know, kind of a goof in the studio. That was just a complete, like, just taking the piss in the studio, just having fun. And you kind of like, okay, that was fun. Let's move on to the next thing. And then once you get that out of your system, you're like, okay, I scratched the itch. It's not there anymore. Let's go, you know, move on to something else. This record, you know, Sunrise on Slaughter Beach, in some regards, is a lot like what you said. Like we have a bit of backup vocals on some songs that we talked about doing that for years, but we always said no because we were like, well, we can't take two more people on tour with us. Logistically, it's more difficult. It's more expensive. But this was the album. We were like, we don't even know when we're going back out on tour, if ever. So bring on the backing vocals, bring on the theremin. But John Paul plays vibraphones. It's probably the most studio-centric album we've done since maybe Blast Tyrant or Jammin', in my opinion.
And basically sounds like it grew organically, though, out of the situation.
I think so.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So when adapting these songs, do you just omit certain parts or like how are you compensating?
Tim learned John Paul's xylophone part the other day. I mean, it's the same chord progression. It's just mm-hmm. got a different drum beat under it.
So just rearranging.
Yeah.
Got it. It's interesting to me because like you just said, you didn't know if you'd ever play live again anyways. So why not just go for it? I do think, though, that there's some music that just, and I'm not saying this about your new record or anything. I'm just saying like as a general statement, like there is some music that's just better in headphones. It just is, like, where it wouldn't sound right without all the little things taken out, whereas sometimes a rearrangement perfectly fine. Just depends on the song, I think.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you got to have good bones to the song. I mean,
yes,
it's like the Rolling Stones, a lot of times those things aren't live, like on stage with them, and the song still stands up. I often wonder, you know, with the Beatles, saying they couldn't hear themselves because of the crowd screaming, or was it because they had so much production on their last records that it was almost impossible to reproduce in that time period because people were so immersed in the headphone world?
We'll never know, but I've thought about that too, because how would a band from that era pull that shit off live? Like how would Dark Side of the Moon happen, or White Album, or a little later, like Bohemian Rhapsody or something? Like how... Because I know now bands just use tracks or they figure out rearrangements. But like with something like Bohemian Rhapsody or, you know, Beatles stuff, that just seems crazy to think about pulling off in the 70s or 60s. I don't know how. Like, and I've tried asking some people who are either that age where they would have worked back then or knew people from the classic rock days, and no one could give me an answer. So I still don't know. And I'm really, really curious about how they would have pulled it off.
Have you ever seen Queen's performance in Montreal? It's a concert and it's the early 80s.
No.
They do Bohemian Rhapsody, but all that vocal stuff is just, it's just piped in. All the mm-hmm. layers. And I believe Freddie Mercury was singing on top of it. But you can paint yourself into a corner in the studio. And one thing I've noticed, just how prevalent and how many bands live, particularly metal and rock bands, that Steve Jobs is a member of on stage, would never want to be in that position where I'm thinking the show depends on how robust your operating system is. That's a world I don't want to live in. Some people are fine with it. I'm not.
Oh, it's terrifying. My band, back when we were touring, we would take a computer because there's orchestration and synth, and can take an orchestra with us. So the computer was the orchestra. It terrified the shit out of me. And there were a couple disaster nights where drummer loses his place, and then suddenly you're playing guitar, but you're in a different section of the song than the orchestra, and it sounds like a disaster. You just got to deal with it. It's not fun. But I know of bands that put literally everything in the tracks, which is crazy to me. That's what is beyond my understanding, is why someone would do that.
That's not live performance.
No, definitely not.
We did a show on this last festival, and there was a band doing just that. Everything, and they were on in-ears. Their front of house sound died, but their in-ears kept going, so they didn't know the difference, so they just kind of kept dancing around on stage to complete silence.
Nice.
It was sort of like, you know, those things like Rolling Stone rips or Kiss rips where it's like all the audio is off.
Ooh, that sounds so awkward.
It was just like that in front of tens of thousands of people.
That sounds so painful to look at.
It was. And I don't know if I feel bad or not.
It's more painful for the people watching than the people on stage, because the people on stage didn't know what was going on.
Well, then I just saw this video of Iron Maiden in the early 80s at a German show, and they were told they had to lip sync. Have you seen this thing? And they all decided just to change instruments halfway through the set.
Yes, I've seen that one.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's where heavy metal's heart lies. Something changed between then and now.
Yeah, I hear you. The last thing I want to ask you about is what it was like working with Tom Delgetty in the studio. I'm just curious what his approach was like in terms of pre-pro. Did you guys do pre-pro with him?
Yeah, I think we did 3 pre-pros with them, right, Neil? Or was it only 2?
3, but the last one led right up into recording.
Yeah.
And what did the pre-pro consist of? Like, how was it defined, I guess?
I guess it was very similar to pre-production with Machine or with Jack Douglas back in the old days, who produced Elephant Riders. You know, when we first worked with Jack Douglas on Elephant Riders, that was really the first time that we'd encountered a producer that had ideas, you know, and that would tell us what our better ideas were. Because I think a lot of times when we're left up, you know, when we're just doing it on our own, we could just second guess everything constantly and just keep changing it and never moving forward. And just Jack was the first person that we ever encountered that had ideas for our songs. And I think Tom was very similar to Jack in that way, where he could, you know, tell us what's good, what's not good, what we should keep, what we should throw out, what the vibe should be. I think he fits more in the category of a traditional producer in that way.
You know, I think that right there is one of the most useful things a producer can do, because lots of people can engineer really well. And that's super important, obviously. It's got to sound right. But the right songs and the right ideas to dig deeper into, and the right knowing what to discard, you know, having someone on board that gets it and has the right taste, it's such a big deal for the outcome, I think, of a record.
Yeah, I think maybe in the early days, we were kind of insulted by the idea of having another creative force while you're working on the album. But over the years, I think we've realized the importance of that.
And a lot of it is psychological. In a studio, you're with a bunch of other people for hours and hours and hours, sometimes not seeing the sunset and getting headachy. And we've dealt with producers who treated us like plugins. Okay, get in the room, do this. He didn't get what he wanted. And he was getting very tense. Mm-hmm. Tom, it was sort of just more of a Zen thing. Like, oh, I have an idea. Work on it. It's no worried. And you have to know how to manage people's personalities individually and as a collective. It's a tricky skill to have while also doing things like EQing stuff and checking compression levels or what have you, and doing creative stuff like jotting down ideas for your post-production. And it's also with a band like us, we've been together for over 30 years. There's so many inside jokes and we're very insular. It can be very difficult for an outside party to come in and gel. It'd be one thing if this band just met 6 months ago, but when you're kind of set in your ways and you have a very nonverbal communication with a person who hasn't been part of that, it can be a daunting challenge. But Tom, he sailed very smoothly into those waters.
But I mean, again, that's a great producer. That is part of the job, is being able to work with a tightly knit group and become an insider relatively fast. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, like, I guess you would call them soft skills, but they're not soft skills. They're really important. But there's a lot of soft skills a producer has to be good at that they're very hard to quantify. There's like no metric for it. Like, are the drums edited? Yes or no. Are they edited well? Yes or no. Or are these guitars in phase? Yes or no. Like, do you like this guitar tone? Yes or no? Like, there's a lot of yes or no. Even if it's a matter of taste, there's a lot of like yes or no types of questions when it comes to production. Or does he know how to mic properly? Do you like how the drums sound? Like, are you using the right snare for that? Like, all these types of questions. But when it comes to understanding the psychology of the people you're working with, not just the band, but like sometimes there's a label and a manager. And so they're balancing those people's expectations while making sure that the artist is the priority. There's all kinds of relationships held in the balance, and producer has to know how to handle that. And every situation is unique. I think that's maybe the toughest part of the job, is being able to adapt to every band and their team on the spot. Do it in a way that helps them do their best work. I think that's a pretty tough job.
That's a gift, not something that you learn at Full Sail.
No, correct. Engineering is what you learn at a school. The human psychology part is, that's something else.
While Tom was over here working for us, he was also working with the Pixies and the Cult. I think he started with the Pixies pre-production. And then he came down and did pre-production with us. Then he went out to LA to work with the Cult. Came and finished our album, finished the Pixies album, and I believe he finished the Cult album as well. So he was basically doing all three of those albums at the same time, which I found totally amazing.
Yeah, being able to balance that is crazy.
Yeah.
And while still making sure that everybody feels like they're getting their full attention.
Exactly.
That's pretty amazing, actually.
So yeah, good producer.
Yeah, totally. So I wanted to ask about him. I think he's great. Anyways, Neil and Tim, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to hang out. It has been a pleasure. I hope that the tour crushes.
Awesome. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you very much.